Amen. We are in Luke chapter 22. We are picking up in verse 54 as we continue on through this section. If you recall, in the previous section, we were looking at kind of this final, these final hours before the crucifixion, where Jesus was praying out on the Mount of Olives with his disciples, just coming from the Last Supper. And he's there, and of course we saw last week, while he's there praying and speaking to his disciples, Judas shows up and betrays him into the hands of the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees and you know, the guards that are there. He hands Jesus off to these guys, and in the process, Jesus calls out kind of the hypocritical nature of this approach. Both by Judas acting like a brother when he is clearly opposed to Jesus, the chief priests acting as though they need to come at him and take him in this way, as if he was some sort of violent criminal. And Jesus points out, like, I was with you guys like every day. Like, any day could have been a fine day to arrest me in the temple. Like, you guys didn't need to come out here in the middle of the night with like swords and clubs and all of that. And so this is kind of the continuation, the passage that happens there, is Jesus kind of points out these false circumstances in which they, you know, arrest him. And so we come to our text this morning in verse 54, and we read this together. Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house, and Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard, they sat down together. Peter sat down among them. So we get a little bit of a scene change here that happens. They're in the process of trying Jesus. They capture Jesus, we're told. They seize him. They lead him away. They bring Jesus into the high priest's house. And the legal activities begin, and they run through the morning, as you'll see. And all the while, we find that Peter, who has been with Jesus thus far, he follows at a distance. He's curious to see what's going to happen. Luke doesn't exactly tell us why Peter follows behind in this sort of way. Perhaps it's, you know, he's afraid for what's going to happen. Perhaps he's simply curious. Or maybe he's trying to really back up his words there. He said, you know, Jesus, I'm going to be with you till the end. And so here he is. We don't get the exact reason behind it, but nonetheless, Peter is there. He shows up, and not only that, he puts himself right in the middle of a really difficult situation there, because you find the setting that he just really settles in is this one where he is surrounded by people who were there capturing Jesus. This is how Luke describes it in verse 55. They had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, and Peter sat down among them. Now, within in kind of significant significant households or significant buildings of this time, they were kind of built with this open courtyard where the servants would be able to gather and kind of be together. The guards would be there. It's really the working people who would be there in this open courtyard, and there they could spend time together. They could have some fellowship. They could warm up in the night watch, and that's really what's happening here. It's the middle of the night. It's cold, and so they strike up this fire in this kind of common place, and everybody's gathered to this one spot there. Again, remember, it's the middle of the night here, and so as they are there, Peter sits down with this group of people, and meanwhile, Jesus is inside this house, and they sit down together, and Luke doesn't really tell us who they are when he says, you know, they kindled a fire, they had this, but it was kind of designed for that group of people, probably who arrested Jesus, the people who went out in this little group there. And as they are sitting there, we find that Peter appears to be recognized. Here's how it's described in verse 56. Then a servant girl seeing him as he sat in the light, looking closely at him, said, "This man was also with him." So all of a sudden, now Peter's there. He's under pressure. He has told Jesus, "Hey, I'm going to be with you till the end. You know, whatever it is, till death, Jesus. Like, I am there. Like, no matter how intense it gets, like, I'm with you till the end." And so he faces now his first opponent, his first person who's coming against him and standing against him. And we find that this, attacker is not a chief priest or a ruler. It's just like a little servant girl. She's like the first level. He can't defeat this first level boss, little servant girl. He's not able to overcome her. You would think with all the talk and everything, Peter would be like, "Okay, I'm really gearing up to stand against, you know, the chief priests, the authorities who are going to come at me." But he just has this random little girl who's at the fire, and she's like, "Hey, this guy was with him," and he that is it shakes him. He says in verse 57, he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." So this girl's question, you know, or she brings this out, saying like, "Hey, you look familiar." It brings out the first denial here for Peter. Both, it's kind of described in two ways there, as Luke tells us, he denied it, and then also you get what he said: "Woman, I do not know him." He challenges her statement. He disputes it. He abandons that accusation. He says, "Look, you have no idea what you're talking about." And then he says it more specifically: "I have no idea who this guy is. I have no knowledge of Jesus." Now, as he does this, when he's kind of communicating this, the words that he uses there, we're not really savvy to them here because we're just getting them in English, but the phrase that he ends up kind of using, that he ends up picking, is very similar to the type of phrasing and words that would be used when a Jewish synagogue would cast out someone who did not want to be a part of the community, who decides like, "Hey, I'm not going to be Jewish. I'm not going to obey your laws or your commands. I'm going to be somebody who is outside of that." So he kind of latches onto that and uses phrasing that is similar to that. They would speak to somebody who wanted to leave that community and say like, "Hey, we no longer know you. We no longer recognize you. We no longer have anything to do with you." And so Peter, he kind of comes in and he takes a portion of that language to help convince that, "Hey, like, I have no idea who this guy is." In the same way that you guys might be familiar with the Jewish synagogue casting someone out here, he's like, I have no idea who this Jesus guy is. Then we find in verse 58 that the passage moves fairly quickly here. And we're told, a little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." So Peter doesn't get up and leave the fire. He's just chilling there still with these people. And then a second denial comes, we're told, a short time after. Someone else sees him and jumps on the bandwagon as well and says, "You also are one of them." So this challenge comes forth. And when he says that, what he's also saying is not just that you are somebody who was with Jesus, but you're one of the other disciples. You're one of those group of people. We know who you are. And this lands upon the previous accusation from this little servant girl. So now we've got two witnesses here. But Peter then says, "Man, I am not." He makes it clear. "Look, you have no idea what you're talking about. I'm not with Jesus, and I'm not one of those disciples. I'm not a part of their ministry. I don't do what they do. I have nothing to do with that service alongside those other disciples. Zero idea. I'm not connected to them." Then we find in verse 59, the passage continues expediently, and we're told, after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, "Certainly this man was also was with him, for he too is a Galilean." So a third denial now comes. After about this hour's break, they recognize him again. They're piggybacking on the previous accusations, and someone else is like, looking a little bit more closely, listening intently, and is like, "This guy has got to be with them, right? This is exactly the type of thing that happens when you, you know, it's like, you see like the scenes in the movies where someone's trying to be like all disguised, and then like slowly people are getting like putting the pieces together, the clues are coming together. That's what's happening here. And finally, this other person speaks up and is like, this guy has to be the guy. Because, okay, he said he wasn't, but look at how he dresses. Now we can see him. Look at how he dresses and look at how he sounds. This guy is definitely with them. He's a Galilean. Of course he's with them. Why else would this guy be here? He's not from this area. He's not from this region. He's not supposed to be over here. Like, why else would he be just like in the middle of all this? It doesn't make any sense. So they have this, you know, they have an hour to think it over before this third accusation comes. But as this is received, verse 60, Luke tells us, but Peter said, man, I do not know what you are talking about. So he succumbs to the pressure again, and he claims, like, I don't know, I don't even understand what you're saying. It doesn't make any sense. But as that happens, we're told, and immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. He denies his link with the disciples. He denies his link with Jesus. He denies that connection. But he can't get rid of his Galilean exterior, the accent, the clothes, whatever it is. That's giving him away. And so he's falling apart. And as he makes this third denial, immediately we're told that the rooster crows. And in this moment, this is like straight out of like, this has got to be like straight out of the like memes that would be shared here, because we're told in verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times. So, I mean, this is just like straight out of like, he's like, I have no idea. And it's like, arr! And then all of a sudden Jesus is like, are you for real right now? Like, you know, it's like, this is like the perfect little section, right? And I don't know how this happened, right? Like, were they transporting Jesus, like, through to a different area? Because Jesus is in the house and Peter's outside. But something lined up in some sort of way where this glance gets to happen. Jesus' glance reminds Peter. And Peter knew that he was denying him. Even from that distance, Peter still feels the presence of Jesus. He knows what just happened. He knows what's occurring. And Jesus knows what's occurring. He's not confused. He prophesied that this would happen. He said that this would happen. And in the middle of this, in the middle of all of this, Peter is just completely destroyed. He is upset because he realizes he has denied Jesus. There was no getting around it. He stands convicted. There are three witnesses who dealt with him. There's nobody could say, well, he didn't really actually know what he was doing. He didn't really say it in that way. He stands convicted here. And Jesus has this glance as if to say, it's exactly as I said. Now, he goes out and he weeps bitterly, we're told, in verse 62. He feels instant remorse over this. This sin of denial crushes him. But in the middle of that, we see the control that Jesus has. Because it wasn't a surprise to Jesus. In fact, Jesus had told Peter, hey, this is going to happen. It wouldn't have been a surprise to the other disciples because they were told, hey, this is going to happen. So if other people found out, like, hey, Peter, you like really did some stuff that was against Jesus, they would just be like, yeah, well, because that's what Jesus said was going to happen. So, of course. But a lot of times when we get ourselves into these sorts of situations, like we end up like, you know, sinning, but then we pretend like, okay, like, oh man, like Jesus had no idea. Like, I can't believe, like, he knew that it was going to happen. And everybody else knows that you need that grace too. Everybody else knows that you're a sinner also, but sometimes we pretend like we're not, and it prevents us from having relationships with other people because we don't want them to find out. But the reality is like we already know. No one's gonna find out that you're a sinner because everybody already knows that you're a sinner. So you're only fooling yourself, really, and you're only handicapping yourself. In the middle of this, right, this whole thing is crumbling apart. It's falling apart. And yet, we see the absolute control that Jesus has. Because he knows what's going to happen. He knows the timing of it. He knows where Peter's going to be. He's in the house of these religious leaders who have him on trial. He's there, and in the middle of all that, he has the control and presence to look over at the time, to acknowledge, to lean in, and to say, it's as I said. So even though it seems like everything's out of control, even though things are spiraling for Peter, and it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening, it looks like Jesus does not have a hand on this. I'm going to be found out. Jesus can't help me. He's like, he knows what's going on. Jesus is not stuck here. He's not being controlled by other people. He himself is ruling from this distance. We get the contrast now to show the restraint and control that Jesus has in verse 63. Now, the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" So it seems here that these are the soldiers, the temple guards. And they are participating in this. Really, I guess they're participating in fulfilling prophecy here. They are mocking Jesus, we're told. They blindfold him. They keep asking him, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" They are making it so he can't see, and then punching him and asking him, like, oh, you know, if you're a prophet, since you're a prophet, you should know which one of us it was who struck you. Go ahead, say the name of the person who hit you. And so in this, they are honoring him as a prophet to a certain degree, but mocking him as well. But again, this in doing so, in participating in this, in their mocking, even this fulfills his prophetic office and role. Because he, if you recall back in chapter 18, what does he say? He will be delivered over to the Gentiles and will be mocked and shamefully treated and spit upon. And after flogging, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise. He said that. So they're exactly doing what he prophesied would happen. They're doing it. Now, that fulfills that prophecy. But here, they're asking him to prophesy again. He's already prophesied what would happen. But they're saying, okay, well, tell us who hit you. Here's the deal. Jesus will not let you manipulate him. So he could do that, but he's specifically not doing it. We already know that he is a prophet because he's being mocked and abused in this way as he said he would. But he's not going to let you use him to get what you want. He's not going to let you use him as a party trick or a magician or a genie. Hey, God, give me what I want. Do this thing. He's not going to allow you to do that. It doesn't fit in with his mission. He's not there to entertain. He's not there to convince you by this cheap trick. He's already explained a much greater prophecy of what would happen, and he's staying faithful to that. He's not trying to just simply impress these few people, but instead, he's looking for the salvation of many. Verse 65, they said many other things against him, blaspheming him. You only blaspheme God. So when it says they're blaspheming him, they're speaking against him. They're acting wickedly against him and against God who the Father who sent him. And so as it's described there, it's Luke is giving us kind of this anchor to different times in the Old Testament where the righteous are rejected. We don't have time to descend into those. But we get the idea that God sends his messengers and they are rejected. They are told what to do. They are told that they are communicating God's message that he will care for his people and that he will not fail, and they reject them. We'll circle back to that perhaps in a little bit, but this is what's happening here. Now, verse 67, or excuse me, 66. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." Okay, now we get into the actual situation here, because he's gone from Peter, we've gone from the text from Peter denying Jesus, and Jesus having control of that situation and seeing what's happening, to Jesus being mocked and abused by these soldiers, and in the middle of that, having control as well, and them taking advantage of him. But then we find, they also blaspheme him again, remember, rejecting him as the servant of God. And then we find now that the chief priests and the elders are basically doing the same. When the day came, the assembly of the elders gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to the council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." So this is the leaders of Israel assembling here to perform some sort of official duty. And in the middle of this, they have people from all sorts of backgrounds. It's essentially the gathering of the Sanhedrin Council, and they are there to bring this judgment upon Jesus, and they ask him, "If you are the Christ, tell us." They go straight into questioning, and he responds back in verse 67, "If I tell you, you will not believe." So they raise this question that is primarily political as the basis for getting Jesus in trouble with Rome. "Hey, are you this guy who's promised throughout all the scriptures, you're a messenger from God who has come here to accomplish this particular task, to overthrow our oppressors? Is that what you're saying?" That's what they're trying to kind of get here, because they're looking to offer something up to the Romans so they can have them kill Jesus. And so they return back to that title, Christ there, which Luke uses many times throughout the gospel. But they are speaking here of this particular title, and they're dealing with him as if he is, right? They're dealing with him and trying to really get him to affirm this, because they want him to affirm this for their own reasons, not because they actually believe in him as that title. The title is a royal title. The title is one that would say that Jesus has authority as one sent from God. And he tells them in verse 67, "If I tell you, you will not believe." He's like, "Look, like there's no point to answer this, because you already believe what you believe. Your minds are made up. You're not trying to actually get... you're not trying to find out if I'm him so that way you can be like, oh, well, we've been waiting for you. And like, this is great. Like, we're so excited you're here." That's not the point, he says. He goes on in verse 68 and he says, "And if I ask you, you will not answer." He's like, if I come back to you guys with questions, you're not gonna come back with any responses. You don't want to have a conversation. Jesus goes on the offensive here and starts to ask them and saying like, this whole thing is unjust. Like, we're not going to have a dialogue. You're here to do one particular thing. But he says in verse 69, he gives us this kind of definitive answer here in verse 69. He says, "But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So what's going on there? Why is he saying this all of a sudden? Because there's a lot of things that are happening here. He's talking about, like, are you the Christ? He's like, I'm not going to tell you. But then he says this a whole bunch of other stuff. And right after he tells them, like, look, like, I could answer you, but, like, you don't really want to know. And also, if I ask you questions, you're not going to answer. So why does he trot out this other, like, large statement? "But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of power of God." He's essentially coming back and he's saying, like, look, you guys think you're the judge, but you're not really the judge. Like, I'm really the judge. You guys think you're in charge of this? You guys think you're going to be the ones who to line up this whole thing and to ask these questions in this particular way and to manipulate things in this certain way? But you're not really the judge. The one who is really the judge is the Son of Man, who shall be seated at the right hand of God, right hand of power of God. He's going back to a text that he has mentioned earlier with them in the Gospel of Luke. In Luke chapter 20, verse 41, remember, he poses this question back to them. They didn't ask, but he poses this question to them. How can they say that Christ is David's son? For David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. David thus calls him Lord, so how is he his son? So he goes back and he references this this earlier discussion that they had about King David and how the Christ and King David are related. And that was connected to Psalm 110. And so he brings this out so as if to say, like, hey guys, if the Christ is the one who is sent, if he's the anointed one, he's going to be the one who is seated at God's right hand shortly, ruling from his side. So if you guys think you're in charge, the one who's really going to be in charge is actually the Christ. So if you're saying I'm the Christ and I'm saying I'm the Christ and we're in agreement here, you guys aren't actually in charge. I'm in charge. I'm going to be the one who is the rightful judge. Though he's before the council, though he is the one who is being taken advantage of, he's the one who has been arrested, he is the one who they have sent these soldiers for, it is Jesus who is the one who will sit at God's side, not the council. It's Jesus who is the one who will be the judge. And so they come back in verse 70, and they all said, are you the Son of God then? And he said to them, you say that I am. So they come back with a response now, and they conclude, rightly, that Jesus claims for himself that unique title, that unique authority. They say, are you the Son of God then? Like, it's not that they are unclear about what he is claiming. Are you the Son of God then? He's claiming this unique, highly exalted position before God. And Jesus responds back, you say that I am. He confirms this through this kind of, obviously they're not asking this question like very sincerely. But he comes back and gives them the answer that they're looking for. You say that I am. And so we find that in this moment, it is the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Christ, like all of the titles, all of the glory, all of the majesty now being confirmed to be on trial before these men. And he says, look, there's going to come a time when I am the actual judge. I'm going to be the one. But for now, let's be honest, let's be real about what's actually happening. And then they said, what further testimony do we need? We have heard it from our own lips. The council's response is that we don't need to have this trial any further. We get what's happening here. He's said everything that we need. We have enough to deliver him over to Rome. Should be pretty straightforward here. He's condemned himself, is kind of the claim. But it's only blasphemy. It's only useful in this way if it's untrue. But this is totally appropriate claims. This is, he is who he said he is. He is all of these titles, all of these offices. And so what they think that they can use to hand over is actually something that is factually true. This is explicitly this group of people denying his glorious name and title. They're explicitly saying, like, you are not who you say you are. You You have not done anything good for us. You're not taking care of us. You've not delivered us from the Romans. You haven't given us what we wanted. You know, if you were, you would do exactly what we wanted. And so because you didn't do what we wanted, now we've got you on trial. Now we are pulling you up here so as to determine if we are going to get rid of you or not. That's how all of this comes about. But in the middle of this, Jesus is still in control. The mob does not rule. Because even through that punishment that will come, even through that punishment that will be delivered up to Jesus, he will still be in control. He will still rule. He will still defeat Satan, sin, and death. It will all be accomplished as was intended. Now, they reject the messenger. They reject that, so God himself has to do the work. They reject the message, so he's like, look, you guys are not going to save yourselves. I will save you. Now, there's another time in Scripture where this happens. There's one other kind of spot here. It's like kind of a real passing moment that you wouldn't ordinarily just be like, oh, yeah, like that makes a lot of sense. But essentially, you find something very similar in the book of Exodus. Right? If you recall, back in the book of Exodus, God takes his people who are he rescues. They've been enslaved in Egypt for, 400 plus years. And in the middle of that, he sees them and he says, I'm going to come rescue this group of people so that way they can be taken out of this slavery and bondage. They can be removed from these hardships and brought into a new land, a new life, and a place where they can worship me. And so he sends Moses as his messenger, his deliverer, to go and to communicate his thoughts to the people. Here's how what I need you to do. Here's how it's going to happen. And in the process of all of this, the people are kind of, really rejecting God, and they go back and forth for quite some time. But finally, in chapter 12, they have this whole thing where the final plague happens. They have the Passover that comes about. And then they leave and make their way into the wilderness, into 13 and 14. And they see these miraculous works where God parts the Red Sea and he provides for them food when they are hungry in chapter 16, and they're looking, they're just like, we are starving, we want stuff, like we want to eat, we want food, and so God provides for them food. And then they kind of come to a time in chapter 17, where they are in a situation where they are thirsty. They need something to drink, and it's a really quick section with like little to no explanation. But here's what you get in Exodus chapter 17. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses said, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? Right? So he's saying, like, look, like, got part of the Red Sea. He took you out of all this slavery. He gave you guys food last time you were complaining. Like, why are you guys just, like, escalating this to the point to where you're just, it's not only, like, you want water to drink, but you're just like accusing God of being bad, of being against you. And so he tells them, like, why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there, verse 3, for water, and the people grumbled against Moses, 'Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried to the Lord, 'What shall I do with the people? They are almost ready to stone me.'" So in this process there, they're all upset. They're complaining, like, God is so bad. He is against us. He has brought us out of Egypt, you know, and he just wanted to, like, abuse us out here, and he hasn't provided any water for us. And they're out of control. And so much so that Moses gets to the point where he's like, this is getting so bad that these people they're trying to kill me now. I'm just the guy who, like, clearly I'm not God. I'm just the guy who's passing along the message. And in the middle of that, the Lord said to Moses, verse 5, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile. And go, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people shall drink." Okay, so a bunch of random stuff there. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" They're like, look, we're calling this because you want to know, is the Lord here or not? Has he abandoned us? Does he care about us? Does he want to help us in the least bit? But the magic of the passage, the understanding of the passage, is something that they pass over so quickly because, like, yeah, we're not people who were living at this time, so it makes no sense to us, right? But this is absolutely connected to God's care and his concern and his love for his people and his absolute control over every circumstance, every situation. And so what happens here in this passage is actually a pretty radical thing because they're complaining, hey, God doesn't love us, God doesn't care of us, he doesn't help us. Like, this guy is not giving us what we want. Just exactly like what was happening here with the religious leaders. They're complaining against Jesus. Look, if you're the Christ, fine. But, like, you haven't overthrown the Romans. You're trying to kick us out of the temple. You're saying we're doing all this stuff wrong. So, like, we got to get rid of you. And in the same way, that's what happens here. Moses says, hey, God, they're trying to stone me. And so what does God do? He tells Moses, hey, go up before the people with some of the elders of Israel. This is exactly the same thing that's playing out here. Hey, go up before them and get all the elders together. You're going to get that. It wasn't the Sanhedrin then, but, like, bring them all together. And I want you to take your staff in your hand. Right? So what has Moses done with the staff thus far? The staff is exactly the same thing as, like, the judge's gavel here, right? He's got this gavel that he would show up and he would call to order the court. He would act as this arbiter, this judge, and he would take this gavel and he would render judgments. Moses shows up and he says, hey, the Lord tells him, hey, take your staff to Egypt. He goes to Egypt. He shows up with the staff and he casts his staff down in the early plagues and he has his staff turn into a snake and eat the other snake of the other magicians. He takes the most prized possession of the people of Egypt, the Nile River, and he strikes it with his staff, and it turns into blood. He brings judgment upon it. That staff is the staff. It's a staff of judgment is what it is there. He uses it, to bring down judgment upon at the Red Sea as the waters come together and they cover all of the Egyptians. And time after time after time again, what happens here is that the staff is brought out to bring judgment upon. And so in this moment, as the Lord tells them, like, hey, get the people together and meet me at this rock and bring your staff, Moses is like, "Ooh, we're about to cook some guys. Like, this is about to get crazy. I'm going to bring judgment down on these people who have been complaining against you, God." But what happens here? God says, "I'm going to come down," in verse 6, "Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb." Now, the person who stands before the group is the person who's being judged. So God is saying, I'm going to be there. I will be judged. Go ahead. I will be the one who will be judged. He's not saying, hey, I'm going to put them there. They're going to stand before me. In every other passage in Scripture, you're going to find that the people stand before God. When they were on Sinai, they stood before God. And he lays out the purposes. Here's the rules. Here's the covenants. But here, God stands before the elders. He stands before them. And he says, Moses, bring your staff. It's judgment time. You guys are going to complain. And Moses is probably thinking, like, this is about to get crazy. God's going to bring judgment upon them. And he gets there, and they're standing, and all the people are there. God is there standing before the people on the rock, and he tells Moses, strike the rock, strike me. And out of me will come life-giving water, will come the sustenance that you need. And that's what's happening here in our passage. The people, the religious leaders, were not getting what they wanted. They wanted to complain. They wanted to put God on trial, on judgment. And they did so. And what Jesus is saying is like, yeah, all of this is untrue. It is that I am who we've all confirmed. I am the Christ. I am the Son of Man. I am the Son of God. Three titles in the passage. And now he's saying, go ahead, strike me. And out of me will come the life that you all need. Receive it. Receive that life. They say in verse 71, what further testimony do we need? What further testimony do you need of God's goodness? What further testimony do you need of his faithfulness? This only confirms the questions that those people had in Exodus chapter 17, and thus we have the name of the place. Is the Lord among us or not? You can say that the Lord is among us. He was willing to receive this strike of judgment, to have this fall upon him so that his people could ultimately be cared for. If there was ever any doubt about who he is, it's clearer than ever now. He has made a way. He has made it clear. He has made it undeniable. What further testimony do we need? We've heard it ourselves from his own lips. No one was without excuse. We're not without excuse. The religious leaders are not without excuse. Nobody is without excuse because he has confirmed it, he has demonstrated it, and he is willing to lay his own life down so that his enemies might live. This is the radical nature of the passage. In the midst of it seeming like everything's out of control, he's been in control the entire time. Not only is he aware that Peter was going to deny him and that he was going to give him that little side glance and be like, look, yeah, I told you that was going to happen. Not only was he able to prophesy that he would be mocked and beaten and blasphemed, not only would he have been able to prophesy if he wanted to, the names of those people who were beating him, but even in this moment, he's demonstrating, you guys aren't really the judge, I'm the judge. And I'm ultimately willing to be judged by you so that way you can go free at a later time when I am the judge. Making a way for life when there is no opportunity. That's the generosity, the kindness, the care, and the grace of the King. Let's pray. Lord, we are thankful for your kindness. We're thankful that when there wasn't a way, when there was no way forward, you made a way, that you went faithfully ahead and you met every need, that you provided for us when we weren't aware or ready and didn't know that we needed that. You deal with our wrestling with you and our rejecting of you, and you welcome us back so faithfully. And so we want to respond to who you are. We want to say thank you. We want to say that we love you. Thank you for laying down your life for us and for being willing to receive that judgment that should have been for us. We want to be found in you. So strengthen us and help us to live out of that new life that you have given to us. We need your help. We love you. Amen.